contains a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 14 days into the month of April. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, two episodes of the Disability Visibility Podcast by Alice Wong. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancekut.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT is hiring a spoken word coordinator. Do you have a passion for storytelling and amplifying perspectives outside of the mainstream media landscape? Are you interested in working at a collectively run, independent community radio station? CKUT's spoken word coordinator is a full-time position starting June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's collective management committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until 9 a.m. on May 3rd, 2021. Please visit ckut.ca for more details. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up first this hour is episode 97 of the Disability Visibility Podcast. This episode is titled Disabled Refugees. That's up now.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations on disability politics, culture, and media. I'm your host, Alice Wong. Today, I have a conversation with Mustafa Rafat, Mustafa is a graduate student in the public administration program at West Virginia University. He's also a trainee at the Leadership Education in Neurodevelopmental Disabilities at the university. Mustafa came to the U.S. as a refugee from Iraq in 2011. You hear Mustafa talk about his experience as a refugee and his adjustment to life here in the United States. Mustafa will also describe the unique challenges and needs of refugees with disabilities. For more, you may want to check out episode 32 of this podcast with Dr. Masha Mirza, who talked about a project in Illinois that helps refugees with disabilities to access employment and career opportunities. Are you ready? Away we go!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, Mustafa, thank you so much for being on my podcast today.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, Mustafa, why don't you first introduce yourself and share anything about your background, if you like.
So, my name is Mustafa Rafat. I am originally from Iraq. I came here as a refugee in 2011. I am also a person with disabilities. Currently, I am a graduate student at West Virginia University. I am also a LEND trainee at the Center for Excellence in Disabilities. And I am also a father of a beautiful daughter named Daphne.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. How old is Daphne?
Daphne is almost 1 year and 4 months.
Wow. So this is pretty new. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, you know, today's episode is about refugees with disabilities. And could you share a little bit about what life was like for you in Iraq and what led you to leave your country?
Before I left Iraq, I just graduated from college. I got my teaching degree, which I was very passionate about. So I got my first job and, you know, I had my first car. So it was a very exciting time. Although I want to say that the war of 2003 really never ended in Iraq, and still it's happening in different forms. So we were living in war. At the beginning of 2010, you know, we experienced an event, and we had no choice except either die or leave our country. And I started this journey alone. I had to leave, you know, everything that, you know, I painstakingly built behind. And I left and became a refugee in Turkey.
Yeah, that must have been really difficult, you know, emotionally. How did that impact your mental health and just, you know, missing your friends and your family and your culture? You know, that must have been quite a shock.
Absolutely, absolutely. And living with disabilities was extra hard on me because I relied on the people around me in Iraq. When I left home, this was not a journey like you go and travel and you come back home. This was one way out. And I still remember those painful moments where I hugged my family and I, you know, I know I am going to unknown future. And it was very, very difficult mentally to accept this reality. This journey, like, is very different for refugees with disabilities, because we start this journey with significant health issues, with significant financial issues, and we lose all the support, so it makes it very, very hard.
When you arrived to Turkey, which was where you first arrived as a refugee before you came to the United States, how did you kind of start over and really, regarding your disability, how did you kind of get your needs back? Because that must have been incredibly scary to be in a new place and to really get the help you need just to live every day.
Most definitely. So first we need to register in a police station in a city that we arrive. So I was waiting in a long line because at that time the war of Syria also started. So there were a lot of Syrian refugees in Turkey. There was an older guy in front of me, and he was trying to explain his situation in English, and the police officer couldn't speak any English. And so he understood something that he thought this guy was, you know, saying something bad to him. And the police officer got angry and he threw his papers. And then he said, "I will deport you. You have no right to say something bad to me." Because I am ethnically Turkmen and I speak Turkish language. So even though I was very, very vulnerable, and I just jumped in and I interrupted their argument, and I said, "Please, you know, you understood the situation differently. This guy did not mean to say things bad to you." And so I calmed the situation and I saved the man from deportation. And the police officer was like, "You know, God send you to me. Now, you know, you speak Arabic and you speak Turkish, so you are going to be my interpreter." And I became an interpreter in a northern city. And that experience really changed my entire life, because I was exposed to these agonizing stories of other refugees. And, you know, like hearing refugees where their first word was crying for hours, trying to explain these painful moments where they lost their homes, they lost their family members. Even though I myself experienced so many traumas, I was very empowered with this experience. At the same time, I also was in a very unique position, because I observed how, you know, children are being forced into child labor. You know, many refugees, like women being forced to prostitutions and all these issues that refugees faced. And I was there to help refugees access healthcare. I was there to help them in legal issues. I was there to help them when they did their interviews in the police station. So that was like an eye-opening for me. I also observed the process of refugees with disabilities trying to navigate this difficult process. Because, like, first of all, to be considered a refugee, you have to meet the definition of refugee status, which says that a person must have a well-founded fear of being prosecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationalities, and membership of a particular social or political opinion. I noticed that It was very difficult for refugees with intellectual disabilities, refugees with mental issues, to explain their situation very well to the police officers who are trying to conduct their first interviews. It was heartbreaking at the end of the interview, like the police saying, like, I can't help this guy because I don't know their stories. I have to, like, document that this person is in danger. You know, that was very difficult time for refugees with disabilities.
I imagine it's still the case all over the world as there are refugees coming to all different places and, you know, fleeing to persecution for all kinds of reasons, including, you know, let's face it, discrimination and persecution for being disabled as well. Because I think there's in a lot of countries, really negative attitudes and discrimination towards refugees. As you mentioned earlier, you know, people can't find work. People, you know, are forced to do a lot of things to survive because, you know, the societies that they're part of, you know, don't want them there. Did you experience any of that while you were in Turkey in terms of, or even here in the United States, xenophobic kind of attitudes?
So there is an idea called medical model. And many nations that accept refugees and they welcome refugees, they use the medical model, which is unfortunately very discriminatory model for refugees with disabilities, because this model says that, you know, disabilities is a medical issues and there's not much that the society can do about. And many nations want to accept refugees who can work and contribute back to their society. But in reality, if we see, especially like refugees with disabilities, you know, when they get the chance to be resettled, they do everything in their power to get education, to go back to work and contribute back to their communities. But unfortunately, most of the time it's overlooked and ignored and not, we don't hear about it. That is the beginning when you are trying to get the resettlement, trying to get your case be accepted. However, it's also important to recognize that, you know, right now there are almost 80 million refugees or people are forced out of their countries. So, and only a very, very small portion of this group get a chance to resettle. So it's a very, very difficult to get resettlement. It's a very long process. And fortunately, during this process, refugees with disabilities, especially their health issues, get worse and worse and worse. I remember when I came to the U.S. and I got my first health checkup, my doctor was shocked and he was like, we have to stop your medications because you are about to lose your kidneys and your liver. And I was like, I'm sorry, but I did not have an access to healthcare during my refugee time. And I was just taking these medication to calm my pain. But I really hope the UN and World Health Organization and other international organization recognize that, you know, that there is a big disparities among refugees with disabilities, at least for them to have their case being viewed equally, because the UN, they believe that it's good to send refugees with disabilities back home, because their home is the best place for them to live. However, the refugee crisis that we are seeing right now, like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, like almost the entire cities are wiped out. There is no community to go back to. So this is very different situation than it was in the past.
What kind of protections and different, you know, services do you think agencies like the UN and other bodies really should make available for refugees with disabilities? Because, you know, clearly there are very few choices, and people are in limbo for years in refugee camps, which is not sustainable or safe for many people. So what do you think is necessary by the groups that are kind of, you know, in charge and just part of the resettlement process?
I mean, from my experience, I really think accessing basic healthcare is crucial. With people with disabilities, their health is the most important thing. And also, you know, financial issues with people with disabilities is a serious problem because they can't work. They can't, you know, do the things that other refugees maybe can do, even if it's illegal. And so, like, having a very basic, like, income, like, that they can at least buy medications, buy some of the basic things. And I also think, like, making sure that their cases are being viewed equally without thinking that, okay, we need to send this group back home when their country becomes normal. Because as we have seen from the situation of Iraq, Syria, you know, Yemen and Libya and other countries, it's been years that we couldn't see any solution for these countries.
I was wondering if you could also share a little bit about your experience in terms of the application process, because I think most people do not understand how rigorous and difficult this process is for all refugees, but especially, you know, refugees with disabilities. You know, what was that like for you in Turkey? In the process of, you know, getting to enter and to reside in the United States?
Yes, God, this was the most difficult process in my life. So there are multiple interviews from the host countries, which in my situation was the Turkish security. So you do interviews almost every other week. At the same time, if the Turkish government accepts your application, gets sent to the UN, and you have to wait until the UN is able to view your application, and the final decision is made by the UN, where they either going to accept you as a refugee, which means that you will have a protection from the UN, or they will deny your case because they don't see a well-founded fear. So there are multiple interviews by the UN, by the host countries, and these interviews have to match somehow. Your story has to be the same all the time. Any small differences can change your application. And after you pass all these interviews, your application gets sent to whatever country is accepting refugees at that time, and your case gets reviewed by that country. If that country accepts your application, then the process of interviewing starts with that nation. And obviously, during this process, there are a lot of traveling from one city to another city to why we are getting these interviews done. And sometimes it can be very, very costly because you have to rent a hotel, you have to travel, bus tickets, airplane tickets. So that's why I was suggesting maybe a very small income would be very helpful, at least for refugees with disabilities. This can take from 1 year all the way to 10 years and even 15 years, depending on the situation.
Did you ever expect that the United States would be, the country that accepted your application? Were you surprised by that?
That was very surprising because, as I grew up, I never thought one day I will leave my home, I will leave my community and travel so far, coming to the U.S. And I be honest with you, I did not watch many U.S. movies, so I never had that dream about, coming to New York or coming to the U.S. So when I saw that the United States is reviewing my case, and after I conducted my interviews, they told me that they accepted my application, that was a very surprising thing, but I was scared because I don't have anyone in the U.S. and, I don't have any friends. So in the beginning, it was very lonely, very lonely process.
Are you curious about what your transition process was like when you arrived in the United States? I mean, what were some of the difficulties, and how did you connect with either, both Iraqi communities and the disability communities in your area?
I got settled in Mobile, Alabama. When I got here, I was physically and mentally exhausted. I was very stressed, very depressed. I could not speak any English. I did not have any financial, stability. My health was in a very bad situation. However, I promised myself while I was in a refugee camp that if I ever get a chance to go to a country, I will do everything in my power to get education and spend the rest of my life helping others, like people with disabilities, refugees, and other marginalized communities. So I remember I told my interpreter that I want to go back to school. And she turned and looked at me and she smiled and she said, "I'm sorry, Mustafa, to say this, but here in the U.S., not everyone get the chance to go to college. It's very expensive and it requires you to have very good English." And that was very disappointing, respond to me. But because of my experience in a refugee camp, as I was interpreting for other refugees, so I was very motivated. So I said, I need to learn English. So despite my physical disabilities, I attended 4 schools in a day. So basically, I was in my first year, I spent my entire days learning English.
Were there other things that, in addition to getting to join the school, what helped you feel welcome?
I was lucky that I met a couple of friends who were from Iraq. And so they were very helpful. However, after 6 months, they moved to Chicago. So I decided to go to Chicago. However, my experience in Chicago was not that good. I realized that even though I was living with 3 friends, it was very expensive, the cost of living. And I noticed that accessing education in Chicago was very competitive. I applied to many jobs, but unfortunately I got denied because people like saw me not speaking very well English and not having any degree, and they saw me a person with physical disabilities. So I applied for a housing program and I got accepted in Morgantown, West Virginia. And I came to Morgantown, West Virginia alone. So here I met a couple of friends who helped me a lot in the beginning. And one of them suggested to me to apply for a disability a scholarship that was offered from one of the local disability organization. So I applied for this scholarship and they told me, yes, you are qualified. And however, you have to pass a comprehensive test. And then if you pass the test, then you will be qualified for the scholarship. So I took the test, and as I was taking the test, I realized that this exam was not testing something that I was exposed to. It was testing something, you know, it was easy for someone who grew up, who went to high school. And so I just realized that this test wasn't unfair and unjust. And I was like, I need to come up with something that helps my counselor understand that this test was not designed for a refugee with disabilities. I told my counselor, please, I need to explain my situation to you. I feel like there was something wrong in this test that you guys need to know. So I told her, like, I am going to give you a very short test. If you passed my test, then I will walk out. I don't need any scholarship. But if you fail my test, you have to give me at least a one chance and help me for one semester. I told her, I'm going to give you a word. If you know this word and if you know how to spell it, if you know the meaning, then you will pass my test. Before I did this test, I asked one of my friends who was in college. I told him, like, can you give me a word like in any course that every college student is exposed to? And he gave me a word in biology. And he said, yeah, every college student needs to like learn this word. So I told my counselor, can you please spell this word for me and tell me the meaning? I did not mean to embarrass my counselor. I just wanted her to understand my situation. So she tried to spell it. She couldn't spell it and she couldn't tell me the meaning. And I told her, like, you see, you are exposed to this word and you finished college in the U.S. and you have a master's degree and you couldn't answer my question. How can you expect me, where I wasn't exposed to all the questions you asked me, to know it? She consulted with her supervisor and they decided to give me a scholarship for one semester. If I completed successfully, then they will continue helping me. And guess what? I finished my bachelor's with an honor. I completed with magna cum laude.
That's a lot of hard work in terms of your advocacy and determination. You know, so many of these application processes, testing, really actively excludes a lot of people. And you were able to identify that. And, you know, luckily you had a counselor that's responded to that. So that's really wonderful to hear, but hopefully you'll make a difference in the way that they think about all the different kinds of students that are applying for this scholarship.
Yes, yes. After me, I encouraged other refugees with disabilities to apply for this scholarship. And I believe three of my friends were able to access this scholarship, and all of them successfully completed their bachelor's.
That is awesome. And it's hopefully just the beginning. You are currently a graduate student and trainee at Leadership Education and Neurodevelopment Disabilities at West Virginia University, and working on a master's in public administration. And you're also working on a project right now to help refugees, especially to refugees with disabilities. Can you tell me a little bit about this project?
Yes, yes. So from my experience, I noticed that we needed to approach refugee issues, especially refugees with disabilities needs, from bottom up, which what means that we need to connect local agencies, local social organizations like disability organizations, rehabilitation services, human rights organizations, and refugee resettlement agencies. So here in the U.S., we focus on work first instead of training first. But we see that refugees with disabilities needs a lot of help in the beginning, because their first year just focuses on getting their health issues taken care of. So they need a little bit more time to gather themselves and access other services. However, there is a gap that refugees with disabilities face. After their time ends with refugee agencies, they are just left out. They don't know what other services are available in their communities. They don't know if there's like rehabilitation services, disability organizations, and things like that. What my project is doing right now, I'm combining that bottom-up approach with biopsychosocial model that emphasizes that we need to reduce that discriminatory policies, we need to reduce that, you know, societal attitudes against people with disabilities, and we need to open the access of people with disabilities to services. So I am going to, in this process, to invite all the local organizations in Morgantown, West Virginia. That includes resettlement agencies, the Center for Excellence in Disabilities, other disability organizations, and rehabilitation services, human rights organizations. And I want to have a discussion on how we can make sure that refugees with disabilities have an access to social services after their time ends with resettlement agencies. So the hope in that is to, we can reduce the timeline that refugees access social services, because without this approach, refugees are left and they wander around, like myself, who traveled three states to find services. So I'm hoping to solve these issues by connecting local organizations and helping refugees access social services easily and smoothly.
What can disability-led community-based groups, you know, what can they do? What should they do to better reach out and serve refugees with disabilities? What would you like to see?
Yes, thank you for this question. I really hope all disability organizations reach out to their local refugee resettlement agencies and ask them how we can help these vulnerable refugees access our services. Because what happened with Trump administration is that the Trump administration reduced the number of refugees accepted to the U.S. from 120,000 refugees to less than 15,000 refugees. That devastated refugee agencies, and many refugee agencies forced to close, lay off their workers. So they are really struggling to meet the needs of refugees, especially refugees with disabilities, which we know they need more help. When disability organization and other social organization reach out to refugee agency and ask like how we can help, I think they are going to strengthen refugees and help them become self-sufficient, become, you know, independent and help them, you know, contribute back to our society.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I guess my final question as we wrap up this conversation is that you talked about earlier about wanting to, you know, spend your life and work serving others. So what do you see for yourself in the future once you get your master's degree? Like, what do you want to be doing in 5 or 10 years from now? What are you excited about?
Yes, so I am in the process to apply for a PhD program. Policy is a very important element while helping marginalized groups. So from my master's in public administration, I am getting this training. From my master's in social work, I got to develop these crucial skills on how to help marginalized communities. However, as I moved on to help, I realized that there's a big gap in research on how to help marginalized and underserved communities, especially refugees with disabilities. So I am really hoping to get my PhD degree and start doing research. At the same time, I hope to become a professor and teach at graduate level.
Well, Mustafa, I am just so thankful that you can share your story with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I am very, very pleased to be on your show. Thank you very, very much for allowing me this chance to have this chat with you, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you, and I wish all the best and with what you do in the future, and just thank you for your wisdom and all the things that you're doing for both communities.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
This podcast is a production.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up next is episode 98 of the Disability Visibility Podcast by Alice Wong. This episode is titled Disabled Students. That's up now.
Hey there, all you beautiful people. Happy year to us, y'all. Welcome to the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations on disability politics, culture, and media. I'm your host, Alice Wong. Today, I'm in conversation with Elena Morales, who graduated with a bachelor's degree in digital sciences with a minor in disability studies at UC Berkeley in spring 2021. Elena is a queer disabled advocate of color and the former chair and co-founder of the Disabled Students Commission. And through loving interdependence and collective labor with her fellow CRIPS, she co-created one of the few disability cultural centers in the country at UC Berkeley. You'll hear Elena talk about developing your disability identity, finding community, and getting involved in student activism at school. You'll also hear about the importance of creating space for the broader disability community with the formation of the Disability Cultural Center and the years-long process that made it happen. Are you ready? Away we go!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, Elena, thank you so much for being on my podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So why don't we go ahead and start with, if you don't mind, just introducing yourself and just sharing anything you liked about your background and who you are.
Yeah, my name's Elena Morales. My pronouns are she or her. I'm disabled. I'm queer, Filipina, Latina, and I go to UC Berkeley. I'm a fifth year, and I'm studying nutritional science. I'm in the registered dietitian program, and I'm also studying disability studies. And I'm also a wheelchair user and a port user, if anyone else is out there.
That's right. Port Pride, right?
Yes. Pump Pride all the way.
I read that about an interview with you, and I love this idea about, you know, just really kind of open and just very visible about all the aspects of who you are.
Thank you. Yeah, it's something I definitely had to take a bit of time. You know, I became disabled in high school, and there's a bit of a mourning period there for sure, but you know, I definitely feel pride now. And the wheelchair, you can see it in an instant, but that's a bit of more of a nuanced accessibility device and something that I don't want to talk about as much. So when I talked to my friend Katie Saban about it, and she also had a pump, we were like, pump pride.
Yeah, that's the thing about pride too, and identity, where, you know, I think there's not a linear path, right? Like so many of us struggle, you know, with feeling comfortable within our own body, mind. But I think that's okay too. I mean, everybody's got their own path, and I don't think, you know, just to be a member of the disability community, I don't think you have to be expected to be this very openly proud and loud person. What are your thoughts on that?
No, it's so true. And I think, you know, because there are so many types of folks in our community, there's just so much nuance there. And I know for myself, like, because my disabilities are based on chronic illness, and they're very unpredictable, some days are good, some days are bad. And because of that, I think, you know, the pride definitely goes up and down. And there are moments where it's really hard, but at the same time, the beauty of it, right, is that you get to connect with other folks that have been through similar experiences as you, different experiences, but maybe have a similar perspective, you know, all sorts of folks that you can talk to. And I think with me, like, just being able to meet someone like Katie that also had a pump, and just to be seen was really big for me, because it's not always out there for us.
Yeah, I feel like that also speaks to, you know, they kind of write down the very narrow ideas of what we think about the word disability. You know, it's still very, you know, much about apparent disabilities. It leaves out so many people who have chronic illness, who are neurodivergent, who have invisible disabilities. And I think, you know, what I've noticed in the last, at least, you know, 10 years, it just seems like to me there's a much more kind of organizing and communities for people with chronic illness. And it's just like to be really wonderful to see, because people do crave connection. And, you know, what has been your journey like in terms of finding community with others like yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think with me, you know, so fun fact, I actually started out as an athlete before disability. I did martial arts competitively, so I was on the whole other spectrum, right? So for me, disability, that I had disabled folks in my family, and I think for me that helped my family support system. When I was really young, my grandma, she had myasthenia gravis, and I took care of her. My whole family took care of her. And she called herself the disabled diva. So for me, I kind of had that perspective as well, just being a family member. And my mom also is disabled. And my brother is disabled. So I was able to find community in my home. at first. And for me, that helped me be more comfortable to just see what's out there and look on the internet, go online, see if anyone else is kind of going through the same things as me, because, you know, the isolation was pretty big. There wasn't a lot of disability representation in my school at the time. And because I was part of that athletic environment, I didn't have a lot of friends that were going through that, if at all. So I went on the internet and I started just talking to folks in the Spoonie community. And that's kind of where I got started with an external community. And I really identified as a Spoonie very strongly in high school, and I still do 100%. But then I did a school project my senior year about Ed Roberts and about UC Berkeley and kind of how that kickstarted the disability rights and independent living movement. And for me, that was like, you know, this light kind of dinged on of, wow, there's so much out there and there's so much history, and it was just incredible. So that kind of kickstarted the wheels of disability. And for me, because I didn't start using a wheelchair or having a port till I was 16, 17. So I had an invisible disability. So when I started using those more visible devices and my access needs were a bit more apparent, that's when I started really learning more about disability as an identity and leaning into that community, kind of just making my own mix of community. And when I got to Berkeley, then I met just so many folks. There's so many different types of folks here. So for me, that was really important. And being at Berkeley has helped me develop my sense of community more, but also kind of like figure out more about myself as well and my identity. You know, where do I stand in all of this? And what are my access needs? And how do I say them loud and proud? And especially like in my field, like doing STEM, there's barriers that I faced being a student in STEM kind of at the time when I was a freshman. And so then I was finding more community to sort of port me through that as well. So there's a lot that's gone into it, but I think for me that was great because I got to meet a lot of people and learn from them, and in that turn learn more about myself, but also help other people and advocate for us.
You mentioned your high school project about Ed Roberts, and you know UC Berkeley is, you know, the premier flagship campus, and it's, you know, has a reputation in terms of really a long history of not only student activism but, you know, disability culture. Was that the draw in terms of applying to UC Berkeley, or just was everything that you kind of expected or thought about, did it be your expectations when you arrived as a first year student, or do you feel like there were things that kind of surprised you?
Right. Yeah. You know, when I was doing my research, I was thinking the whole time, like, oh my gosh, UC Berkeley must be the most accessible campus ever, because all these amazing activists came out of it, and you know, we kind of spearheaded these conversations and access on a campus, on university campus. And so I really thought it was going to be this ginormous disability community with the most access out there, no ableism, but obviously that was not the case. So I got there and I was interested in advocacy. So I went to my first meeting at the Disabled Students Union, and there was only a couple people there, and I was like, well, I was expecting dozens of people, and the community was just not as visible as I thought, and I was having some issues with accommodations and just professors, and in STEM I was having a lot of lab accommodation issues, so it really surprised me. And I think that's when I got more into activism, was because I was seeing kind of the problems that were arising. And I knew that the community was there because I was meeting so many people, you know, disabled staff, disabled students, and community members, and they're there and they have these underground spaces, but it wasn't really visible on campus. And that's when I knew that I wanted to be part of what was going on and the activism that was happening. Even if it was not as visible at the time, I wanted to help make it a bit more out there. And also, you know, what that helped me as well, because I learned a lot from other folks and I was able to self-advocate better because I wasn't getting what I needed. So I was able to, you know, get the accommodations I needed and learn how to advocate for myself in classroom spaces as well.
And, you know, as a fifth year student, you must have a pretty good sense of kind of overall some of the broader issues that students face. Is there anything that, you know, in addition to what do you think you face yourself, but also other disabled students, what are some of the major things that students are dealing with right now, especially, you know, in the midst of the pandemic at UC Berkeley?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a couple main themes that kind of lead to some issues. So the biggest thing is that I've experienced, but I've heard, and just what you kind of see on campus is the isolation that disabled students experience on campus. You know, because the structure is designed to, you know, the disabled students program, which is where we get our accommodations at UC Berkeley, and the Disability Access and Compliance Office, those are compliance-based spaces. And when you get your accommodations, they don't reveal your identity. You just give your letter of accommodation directly to your professor. And, you know, so students aren't able to really find each other, DSP students. And just in general, because of the way that system is designed, you could be sitting next to a DSP student in your class of, you know, 500 people, and you wouldn't even know that they're also disabled. So that lack of ability to find each other is...
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to part of an episode of the Disability Visibility Podcast by Alice Wong. If you would like to listen to the remainder of this episode, go to disabilityvisibilityproject.com, click podcast, and then episode 98. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalanchecKUT.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at CKUT.ca. Stay tuned for Jose, that's up next. We'll be right back.
can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the best.